Today's episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. So whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you've been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. That's DiabolikDVD.com. Today's episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. So whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you've been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. That's DiabolikDVD.com. Welcome to the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Ryuhei Kitamura is a Japanese director of such movies as Versus, Clive Barker's Midnight Meat Train, No One Lives, Downrange, and the Machete segment of Nightmare Cinema. Ryuhei's director origin story is really inspiring. When he was making his feature debut, Versus, he went through a brutal series of hardships, but still managed to pull off an extremely impressive film that was loaded with these very complex zombie fight sequences and gore gags. One of the things that really stands out in Ryuhei's career is his relentlessness. Throughout his career, a multitude of things kept not working out, but he just pushed on and on until he became the director that he is today. Overall, Ryuhei's story is a true tale of pioneering filmmaking, and he claims that one of the main things that got him through the challenges that he faced was his samurai spirit, which we hear a lot more about, as well as very entertaining stories about how much boldness can pay off, as well as details about Ryuhei's collaboration with Clive Barker. All of this and so much more on this episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Now, please give it up for Ryuhei Kitamura. I mean, to go back to the beginning, George Miller and Mad Max had a huge influence on you. In fact, you quit high school at the age of 17 and you moved to Australia to attend film school.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good story, but it's not only the one reason. Because I lived there, I have my family there. My aunt, she married like long time ago a Mexican sailor. They fell in love, and you know they moved to Australia like 50 whatever years ago. You know, So my dad took me to Australia to visit my aunt, and you know I woke up one morning and she was gone. So I was like, what? Why my dad went back, and my aunt told me you're gonna go to school. It's like, what? I couldn't even speak, you know, yes or no. I couldn't speak zero English, and they just threw me into this, you know, not a Japanese school, just a local school.
Wow.
So it was a struggle, you know, first, you know, couple of months, but you know, kids are much tougher than adults, right?
Oh yeah.
So they always find a way to adjust. So I started to make my friends, and you know, that was my first experience in Australia. That was back in 1980, I guess, when I was 11. So I lived there for like a year, and you know, only way to learn English is, of course, you have to make friends, and you start, you know, to speak, even though you can't really speak. But I, you know, my first way to learn English was go to watch movie. And so I went to the movie theater every day. And, you know, when there's no school, I go to theater and I just keep on watching, stay in the theater for all day and watch the same movie again and again and again. So I can say that I learned English from watching this amazing movie called Breaking Away. the bicycle race movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I watched that movie in the theater for like, I don't know, at least like 50 times.
Wow.
When it came out. You know, because I didn't have many friends in Sydney, you know, I was a lonely kid, and I just, you know, stayed in the theater, and I started to figure out, you know, what they're talking about, what is the story about. So that was that's how I went into this, you know, world of the movie. So when I was 17, I started thinking about, you know, what am I going to do in my future, and I just knew that, you know, I got to be film director. And yes, I lived in Australia, and I love Mad Max. I love Mad Max too. I loved Razorback, Highlander, from Australian director Russell Mulcahy, and I like Man at Work. I love In Excess. So like everything was like telling me I go down under. So that's how I just picked. You know, it was either America or the Australia. But you know, it was back in 1987. Still, Australia, not many people really knew about the country. You know, still the mysterious country, and you know, it was, you know, somehow the thought of, you know, going to Australia, the land of Mad Max, was, you know, fun for me.
Cool.
I wasn't really thinking.
So why did Mad Max mean so much to you as an aspiring filmmaker?
I mean, especially Mad Max 2. I mean, you don't even have to ask, you know, everybody in the world, you know, still loves that movie, and you know, and George Miller is I think he's the only one director, and it's still at age 70, you know, and nobody really believed that, you know, when he announced, you know, he's going to do Mad Max 4, that, yeah, I mean, yes, it's George Miller, yes, we're going to go, it's hard to hate it, but nobody expect that, holy shit, I mean, he's going to do better than Mad Max
2. Oh, yeah.
So when the first time I saw Mad Max, and especially the Mad Max 2 came out, I mean, I was like, wow, this is like completely different from the first movie, but still has this same kind of spirit. Mm-hmm. And he showed me the world that, you know, I haven't seen, you know, before that movie. Yes, after Mad Max 2 or after Escape from New York, a lot of, you know, post-apocalyptic movie, you know, and the manga and animation came out. But the before Mad Max 2, something like that didn't really exist, you know. Mm-hmm. In that quality. So I don't know, I mean, it was very unique, and that fascinated me.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And then luckily George Miller apparently is coming back and doing another one. He's going to do a prequel.
Amazing. Yeah,
I know, I can't wait. It's a good time to be alive, right?
Yeah. And I got a few, you know, like just this, you know, times, you know, between like around 1978 to 1980-81 especially, you know, I lost my mother when I was like 8, so I was very lonely, and you know, it was just me and my dad. You know, it was just, you know, me and him, and my father had to move around a lot of different places in Japan, and you know, he was struggling in his business. So if you move around the school, you know, like every 3 months, it's very hard to, you know, make a friend. Mm-hmm. And yes, I said, you know, kids are tough, but kids are sometimes, you know, also very cruel, right?
Oh, yeah.
The new kids. So I wasn't really adjusting into, you know, any of those schools, you know, when I was moving around with my dad. So, you know, I didn't have my family, my home, or my school, or my local, you know, hometown, you know, because I was moving around. So only escape for me was while I'm at the movie theater, you know. So the movie meant very special to me, right? So I got I got a lot of influence from those, you know, 1978, 1979, 98, 81, 82, that time, you know, especially the movie, you know, because the movies were kind of my parents, my friends, and my teacher, because I didn't even go to school that much, you know. So I got lots of influence. And the other influence I had was, of course, the 80s horror movie, you know. I think, the dawn of splatter movies, Friday the 13th, My Bloody Valentine, Halloween, you know, then, of course, Nightmare on Elm Street. So all those, you know, the movie, because I love to watch, you know, all kinds of movie, you know, it doesn't matter. And I even love the movie, like, you know, Bridges on Madison County, but those movies like Mad Max or, you know, Friday the 13th, those movies fascinated me because something like that kind of, you know, that kind of world. I don't really want to live in that kind of world.
Yeah. It's fun to watch, though.
Only in the movie, yes, you show me this something unreal, the fantasy. You know, sometimes it's a very bloody gore fantasy, but still it's a fantasy. And I really enjoy that kind of world, you know. So I was fascinated by the person, you know, the people who create this, the vision. So it was very natural for me to, you know, started thinking like, you know, what I want to do in the future, or I want to make a movie like that. Mm-hmm. So everything was very natural for me.
Very, very cool. So I think one of the things I've learned talking to a lot of directors is that obviously when it comes to directing, yes, it's important to have a good actors, a great script, to work with your actors on finding an emotional connection with the characters, working with your DP to make sure everything looks fantastic and feels right. But largely beyond that, it seems like the real job is to face unbelievably huge challenges, overcome a lot mm-hmm. of adversity, take really small budgets and make unbelievably larger looking production values out of really, really small opportunities, and turning small opportunities into larger yes. opportunities. And I feel like what really is a huge example of that is when you made Versus, and you made that for very little money. And when you mm-hmm. watch the movie today, it holds up so well. And there's so many unbelievably complex sequences. And from what I heard, with your really awesome interview with Mick Garris, and I definitely encourage everybody listening to check that out, is that it was a really, really, you had run out of money and you still were able to make the movie. So could you, mm-hmm. there were some skills inherent in that, that I think a lot of directors, I think that they need to realize that it's not just about having a great vision. It's about pulling your cast and crew through really difficult situations, being persuasive enough and earning enough loyalty to get your cast and crew to go through those difficult scenarios with you. But could you talk a little bit about that and how you were able to overcome huge odds when you were making Versus? Because I feel like it's a hugely important story for aspiring directors.
That's probably, when I was making Versus, which is almost like 20 years ago, mm-hmm. One thing I can say is I was probably the craziest director in the entire world. And the part of the reason was, you know, like I said, kind of like, I mean, doesn't matter if you're a director or you're a painter or you're a musician, you know, if you are a creator, you know, that means you have to create something out of your heart and soul, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, to me, the filmmaking directly connects to my life. And like I said, you know, I had a tough childhood, you know, life. And because of that experience, you know, it was a little bit sooner than a lot of my friends at that time. But when I was 17, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, right? Mm-hmm. So one day it was boring Japanese lesson. And I started thinking about what am I going to do with my life. And I just made my decision because I was old enough to know, even though I was like stupid 17-year-old kid, but I was, you know, I had so much experience already, you know, up and down, and mostly down with my life. So I was kind of, you know, tough enough, wise enough to know that whatever you do, life is it's just a gamble no matter what. So I decided to make my decision that, you know, I'm going to be the director. I'm going to be the Hollywood director, you know, and I just believe in myself and I just keep on betting until I win. You know, I know that it's not going to be easy at all. I felt like, you know, well, this dream is like, I don't even know where is the goal. It's like far beyond the horizon. Mm. Right? Because that was back in 1987 in this small town in Osaka. You know, high school kid don't say that, right?
Right.
especially in Japan, you know, when you were 17, you start thinking about, you know, you study at school, then you go home, then you know, you have the private teacher and you have to study like another 6 hours at your home until like midnight to get into this, you know, win the race to get into this university. You know, then, you know, after 4 years of university, you have to now in the race to get into this good company. And Japan is kind of still like that, but I just, none of this didn't any make sense to me. I mean, what is the good university? What is the good company? It's all about what do you want to do? What do you love, right? So I was like, I'm out of that race. I don't want to do it. So so I started thinking about what I love, what I want to do. So a lot of things I love, but then everything, you know, I was doing the boxing because of Rocky. You know, I wanted to do that, you know, be in the rock band because I, you know, started listening to the soundtrack. You know, I want to be the, I wanted to be the, like a writer because, you know, I started reading the book because I wanted to find out, you know, oh, this movie is based on the book. I want to read the books. You know, that's how I went deep into the book. So I realized that everything started from the movie. You know, without the movie, I never wanted to, you know, be in a rock band or started the boxing. You know, so okay, so it was natural. So I stood up and I, you know, declared to everybody in my classrooms that, you know, hey, you know, bye, you know, I'm quitting and I don't know how, but I'll be the film director. And I'm not talking about the small director in Japan. I'm talking about the Hollywood director one day. Then, of course, you know, half of the classroom laughed. Right? I said, what are you talking about? You know, quit dreaming. So, like, we were 17-year-old, and then you tell me that quit dreaming? Come on. It's all about the dream. So, you know, well, you know, it's my life. You know, you're not going to wipe my ass, you know, so shut up and just get out of my way. I'm going to do what I want to do. So I declared that to my classroom, and I was so serious about what I said that day when I quit high school during the Japanese lesson. So, you know, I just determined myself that I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give up no matter what. Because if I give up, if I'm not going to make it, I'll be embarrassed. You know, what I said 30 years ago, right? So, there's a lot of people who says a lot of things, a lot of great things, you know, and a lot of, you know, and it's easy to say that when you're in this, you know, uplifting wind. But the problem is when you start to fall down, how are you going to react?
Yeah.
What are you going to do when you go down? You know, so I don't know. Somehow when I was 17, I already knew that because I had this, you know, turbulence life, you know, experience. So I just knew that, you know, no matter what, you know, I'm being, you know, hit hard and I'm thrown into the, you know, turbulence or the storm, I will not give up. So when I started Versus, you know, I was kind of, you know, at the edge, very, very close to the edge because I was 28, 29. Again, in Japan, you know, when you graduate school, when you are 23, 24, you know, you just, you know, get a job. Then you get married, you have the family, and that's the beauty of the life. You know, most of people think like that. So think about, you know, when you were 28 and you're telling everybody that I'm going to be the Hollywood director and you actually not doing anything, right? So I knew that my time is running out, right? And before Versus, I did this tiny movie called Heat After Dark, which is my, you know, for very first theatrical, you know, movie. And I'm still proud of it, but when I was doing that movie, it was tough, you know, because I was nobody. I was only 26, 27-year-old, nobody kid from Osaka, went to Tokyo. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have this big star, you know, agreed to do this tiny independent movie with me. But the budget was, you know, very low, and it was only 10 days of shooting. And in this 10 days of shooting day, typhoon hits twice.
Oh, my God, twice.
In 10 days. And I never had any experience. So, you know, nobody really listened to me. You know, it was like, you don't really understand filmmaking, you know, just, you know, what just pro do. So that was the attitude, you know, I didn't have this, you know, this strong personality enough to control this, you know, much experienced people, you know. I was the youngest one. I had zero experience, so it was very tough. Right? Then I was, you know, thrown into this, you know, this crazy fight, you know, to fight about this movie rights and all this, you know, many times these producers, you know, they are the ones start the war against you, right? So again, I was 27 and I didn't know anything about the film industry. I was like, oh, really? I mean, you tried to rape my movie and you tried to kidnap my movie. I mean, no, I'm not going to let you do that. So it was a nasty fight and it lasted for like 2 years.
Oh my God.
Which hit me hard because I was nobody, right? But after 2 years, finally this fight is over. So the movie came out. It was a small movie, small release, and it didn't change my life. And I was, you know, I thought that, you know, wow, I'm probably the one of the youngest director who get the chance to make the movie with this big star in Japan. So I thought that, you know, life gonna change. But the fact was, life didn't change. So I was 29. My first movie didn't really work. And I had no money, no future, nothing, right? So, but again, I just determined myself that I'm not going to give up. So I decided to do. And one mistake, because it's easy, so easy to blame somebody else or the situation, right? And people, we are weak to do that, right? In a tough situation, we always point the finger at somebody else or at the situation, like right now, you know. So, but again, I'm lucky that I didn't think like that, and I think like that, and I was like, you know, I wanted to kill this producer. I mean, why? And you know, I was just angry at everybody. But after a while, I started think like, no, everything is me. You know, I was weak enough and I wasn't clever enough and, you know, I wasn't experienced enough and everything comes back to me. So I, instead of blaming somebody else, I just, you know, blame myself and I said, I have to do this again. So one big mistake I did was, you know, my first movie was, you know, I was so dependent on somebody else, these big stars, you know. So I said, okay, so because, you know, I just hang on them, you know, because they are the big stars, you know. I listen to them, and life didn't change. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to need the star, you know. This movie, I will be the star. I will be the king, and I do everything on my way. Otherwise, what's the point of doing this? So I wrote this script, and I went to everybody. Seriously, everybody in Japan, everybody laughed at me, you know. This is just nonstop. 2 hours, crazy zombie, kung fu, gangster, samurai action movie. It's just pure action, and we don't do this. You know, we're not Hollywood. We don't have money. We're not Hong Kong. We don't have the action star, so we don't do this. We just don't do this kind of movie in Japan. This is a video game script. This is a manga script. This is an animation script, not the live action. So, you know, the power I had was like, okay, so all right, 100%. Japanese film industry ignore me and nobody gives me a chance and no, it's not going to stop me. So I ended up, you know, calling everybody, seriously, everybody asking for money, everybody, all my friends. And I didn't have any, you know, millionaire, billionaire celebrity friends that time. So, you know, they were all my regular friends and somehow they started to, you know, give me the money, $3,000 here, $10,000 here, $5,000 here, $20,000 here. And it's a tough money to ask, you know, because it's not a giant studio. It's just rich people. It's just regular people, you know, while I'm dreaming still, I'm close to 30 and I was still dreaming for my life. You know, my friends were, you know, they had a regular job and they were working hard, you know, and still they invest in me. And that was a heavy money to carry. But then I, you know, ask myself, if you're freaking out, don't do it. You know, if you don't have 100% confident, don't do it. You know, because this is not the rich money throwing the money at you. You know, they walked hours and hours and hours, you know, and they just give you the money, you know. So if I'm not confident, then I don't do it. But I just made up my mind and I'm going to make this happen. So first money I had was like, I don't know, like 50,000. And then I started picking this unknown wannabe actors, not real actors, you know, but doesn't matter, you know. I just picked everybody in my first instinct. And then a lot of people started to gather around me and ended up, we were like, I don't know, 50 people. So 50 people, we went to this, you know, off-season ski lodge. And I convinced the owner, we were just 20 people and we were going to in and out in 2 weeks. And he agreed with very little money. You know, then ended up, you know, they were like, I don't know, 70, 80 people showed up. And after like a month and a half, we were still there. So he got so mad and he kicked us out. So suddenly we lost the location, we lost the accommodation, and we didn't have money. So then I took my entire crew and cast to my hometown, Osaka, because Osaka had a lot of friends. So like, you know, these three actors stay in this my friend's house. These guys stay in this house. And I just kept on doing. And $50,000 at the beginning, that money disappeared in like, I don't know, less than a week.
Whoa.
Yeah. And again, the thing I don't know, it was, now I can say that, you know, I made the right decision, but everybody thought I was crazy. It was first 1 week, nothing worked out. Nothing really worked out. Because the script was crazy, big enough, and, you know, we were a bunch of amateurs, you know. That stunt coordinator, Yuji Shimamura, he's one of the biggest stunt coordinators in Japan now. But those days, 20 years ago, he was still, you know, learning. You know, I was learning, he was learning, and none, you know, no professional actor, no professional crew. We didn't have AD, we didn't have sound, we didn't have light, we didn't even have a slate. That's how amateur we were. That's how amateur we were. Only thing we had was, you know, a bunch of like street fighters and, you know, me and my crew who was still, you know, not a professional yet, and this Super 16 camera. That's it. So when the sun goes down, we can't shoot anymore. We couldn't shoot anymore. So we went back. Then we cooked out for ourselves. Then from day one, we were like way behind the schedule. So I was like, oh, my God, how am I going to survive this? Then the money starts to run out, and I have 50 people to feed. So, you know, when the sun goes down, while my cast and crew are cooking the dinner, I was calling everybody and asking, like, I need money, like, tomorrow. Can you do me a favor? Can you buy this, like, you know, 50 lunch box and deliver to this mountain tomorrow? That's crazy. But I was doing that somehow to every day, right? So, you know, nothing was really working first 1 week, 10 days. And, you know, I knew that I was in deep shit, you know. Then, of course, you know, those days we were still shooting, you know, not the digital. So it takes days to watch the dailies, right? Then, like, you know, first 1 week passed, and we started watching the dailies, and, you know, none of this was really working, you know. So I was like, I said, like, you know what? I mean, I have to do this again. So I decided to throw away probably 80% of what we shot.
Ooh.
And everybody was like, what? I mean, this camera is not right. So I called, you know, the other guy. You know, he was still assistant, and he was the first assistant for my first movie, Heat of the Dark. But, you know, and I called this guy Takumi and said, you know, Takumi, do me a favor. I'm doing this movie, and, you know, this team is not working. I need you to come and, you know, take over. And I have no money. And he did came, and he ended up my guy. You know, he and I, this Takumi Fu and I, you know, did all this Azumi and Godzilla, and he even shot, you know, my new movie called The Doorman, you know. So he even did the Hollywood movie.
Wow.
You know, 20 years. But that time, you know, he was still nobody. He was just assistant. But I just knew that this guy, I need this guy. So I brought him, you know, and his team, and replaced this, you know, the camera unit, and throw away 80% of the footage we shot. And I was like, you know, no, this is not what I want to do. After all this trouble, you know, asking a lot of money to my dear friends, no, I can't. So I know I fucked up, but I'm going to throw this away, and I'm going to reboot right now. So that's what I did. You know. So because of the loss of this, you know, throwing out like 70, 80% of the first week, you know, I mean, that's a huge, if you only have 50,000.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So of course the money ran out, and I just, you know, I just called everybody every single day. you know, I don't know how I did it. And I don't know how many, if I can do the same thing now, I don't think I can, you know, but even that, you know, money runs out and we were kicked out of this, you know, the ski lodge we were staying, and the snow started to fall. We started shooting like end of September, and then, you know, it's got to get into late November, and, you know, snow started to fall. So we had to shut down anyway. So while, you know, they shut down, of course, a lot of people told me that, well, but still, we have tons of footage. You can just edit and, you know, you can just finish the movie. And I said, no, 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 this is far from finished. So I'm gonna find more money somehow, because we can't really shoot for a couple months anyway. So while we were shutting down, I was making that miniature at the last scene in the Versus, which is like kind of like Mad Max Thunderdome Escape from New York looking. And I was making that kind of, you know, the post-apocalyptic city with these cardboards and plastic models and everything, because we had time. And the photo session for the poster, that iconic image, you know, later became the poster where I was doing the Photoshop. So I was a photo shoot for that and look for another money. And when spring comes, you know, we went to Osaka and we kept on shooting. Then in the end, I can't let my crew and cast stay at my friend's house for like a couple of weeks, right? 3 days maybe, but, you know, if it's more than 1 week, that's too much. So in the end, you know, we had nowhere to go, and I had zero money for accommodation. So we came back to Tokyo, and we found a forest, you know, outside of Tokyo. So that's where we shot. You know, we were that stupid. You know, I was like, really? It took us 6 months to find out that shit, there is a forest near Tokyo. Why we were jumping around all over Japan? Wasting a lot of money for the accommodation. I mean, but so the final, I don't know, couple of weeks, we were shooting in Tokyo, and everybody was just telling me, I mean, you just keep on asking a lot of people a lot of money, and seems like you never know when to end. I was like, I'm going to end when I'm satisfied. And that's kind of, you know, crazy, but kind of ideal filmmaking, which I'm not allowed to do anymore. It's sarcastic, but when you're a professional director, yes, you have to protect schedule and money, no matter what, right? So sometimes I feel like, you know, I mean, that was very, very lucky that, you know, I had the freedom to do that, because actually my life was dependent on it. I just knew that if this movie doesn't work out, you know, I'm dead. You know, I cannot say, you know, I'm a talented film director to anybody anymore. Again, I cannot ask money to anybody again. This is it. This is the one last chance. So that's why, you know, I just, you know, didn't hit the brake. I just kept on, you know, just speeding up. And so we shot, you know, 4,800 setup, which is crazy.
Oh.
In Super 16 film with no slate, no sound. So now I had to edit this mountain of film. So I started watching the footage and I was like, what is this half second shot? What is this? This close up shot. Does everybody remember? Anybody remember? And nobody remembers that. I was like, what did you, I asked my actor, what did you say? I mean, it doesn't match the script. Well, boss, you were just improvising everything on the set. Okay, and nobody even recorded or write down what you say, so nobody remember the dialogue. So I had to like, you know, figure out that the new dialogue to match the mouth. This is like so amateur filmmaking. So I started to, you know, cut my film in old school way, but then I realized that this is impossible. It's just impossible to edit this. Only way to finish this is using this Avid system, the computer, which was very rare in Japan back in 1999. Only three big editors had it. Only three. And wow. Of course, only three big rich editors had it. Nobody else. So like, I was like, oh my God, you know, so somehow we have to find the editor. So we went to this, you know, one of the most famous editor in Japan, and Kakesan and his office, and started unloading this, you know, amount of Super 16 footage. So he came up and he said, like, you know, who are you? What is this? What is this? You know, get the hell out. I was like, I shot this crazy movie, and this is not only the future of me, this is the future of Japanese cinema. And 4,800 setup, no sound, no slate, no editing seat, nothing. So the only way to edit this is I need your help. And I have no money, but this movie will change my life and I will pay back. And then he laughed and said, I'm in this industry more than 35 years. And, you know, it's still in this industry. People say that, you know, mm-hmm. I'll pay you back when I get famous.
People say it all the time.
No, but I've never seen anybody did that. So I looked right into his eyes and said, you know, I will be the first. I was just, somehow it worked. He believed me. So he said, all right, let's take a look. And he was, you know, of course he was a busy editor and he was working on a lot of big studio movie, but he gave me 100% of his passion. And he called this lab, which is Imagica, which is the biggest, you know, lab in Japan. And he made a call to Imagica when we finally finished the movie and said, like, you know, hey, this kid has something. So just let us use your screening room just one time for free. And they did it. So we did this one screening at the Imagica, you know, for free. And Kakesan was very nice to invite all his producer friends. And one of the friends became the producer of my next movie, Alive. So he really, you know, helped me. So I had a lot of support from a lot of, you know, from my friends to this big editor to, you know, everybody. And I don't know. I mean, when you were that crazy and when you were that serious and, you know, when you have that crazy, you know, passion, you know, I think, you know, you can move people. And, you know, film director, you know, it's a tough job, you know, because I always think that film directing is, you know, really, film director is this very strange job that you don't really do anything. It's the crew, you know, DP makes that beautiful, you know, picture, and the actors, they act, and the composers with the music and everything, right? Production designer, everything. And most of the time, you know, producer is the one, you know, finding the money. So I always ask myself that, you know, so what is your job? What is your job? You know, everybody call you boss, but what is your job? It's not really you doing, you know? So I always, you know, tell myself that, you know, I my job is to, like it says, you know, give direction. So I have to open up my drawer, you know, from my soul. And then I just throw out lots of, you know, fancy toys and throw at my crew and cast, and I can, hey, you know, grab this. What do you think? You know, to ignite their creative, you know, senses, mm-hmm. you know, because without my crew and cast and the producer, I can't really do anything, you know. Yes, I used to do it, you know, but right now my vision is getting bigger and bigger and I really need their help. So, yeah. So only thing I can do is that, you know, I have to be serious more than anybody and I have to be passionate more than anybody on the set. Yeah. You know? And, you know, every single day, every single moment, you know, to just let them excite, mm-hmm. you know, make them feel that, you know, it's fun to work with this crazy director. So, you know, that's what I've been doing since when I was, I don't know, 17, 18. Yeah.
Well, how did you find the confidence to be able to pull that off? I mean, these were really difficult circumstances where most people would have quit. And then you make the movie and then you go to the editor and say, I have no money. I need your help. I'll be the first one. Where did you find the confidence to do that?
It's not really the confidence. You know, like it says, you know, to me, movie making is my life, you know, myself. It's my reason of existence, you know. So I don't think it's possible for me to find another way to live. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, especially in a time like this, you know, I mean, the world as we know is like changing drastically in a time like this, right? So of course, you know, I was supposed to shoot something in Japan and then something in Hong Kong right now, and everything is pushed. And you know, of course, as everybody else, I started to think like, I mean, I need to figure out, you know, what I'm going to do. But then a hundred times I tell myself like, you know, hey, you know, filmmaking is not an easy job, you know, to and especially in a time like this, I mean, this is tough. So you have to start thinking about, you know, different kind of job, right? Then immediately I'm like, no, I mean, it's impossible for me to do anything else. This is the only thing I love and the only thing I can do. So it's not really the confident. It's like, you know, I have no way out, you know, because this is the only thing I love, you know. So so when you think the movie directing, you know, to be the filmmaker is your job, you know, if I think like that, I would have quit many times. But, you know, filmmaking, the movie directing is myself, my life, you know, it's everything to me. So I can't really quit. That means suicide. So I can't do that. So, you know, that's why. And because every time I make new movie, you know, and I'm sure you know it, but just every single day, it's like, you know, 300 problems rise up. Right? Every day on the set, like, I mean, and most of the time, it's nothing to do with you, right?
Right.
I'm doing the right thing, and my actors are doing, like, my crew are doing the same thing. But always, if you have, like, you know, 50 people, 100 people involved in the movie making, you know, it's impossible to have everybody, you know, picture perfect.
Right, of course.
This parasite and sharks, you know, liars, and it feels like it's like always the enemy within situation. Right? So every single day, this liar and every, you know, and so, like, you know, many problems rise up. But then I keep on telling myself that, you know, let's say if I die, like 6 months from now, a year from now, this will be my last movie, and I have to try harder, you know. I feel like, you know, I want to just put the blame on everybody else, and I just want to justify myself. And it's just one of the, you know, 13, 14 movie I've done, you know, and I have the next movie, I'll do better. You know, it's easy to say that, but I just can't do it. I don't do it, you know. I just, no matter how hard it is, I have to at least try so that I can be proud of my movie, you know, because if I die, this will be my last movie. And, you know, I mean, no, I mean,
yeah,
it's impossible. It's probably impossible to do, you know, 100%, you know, satisfied movie. You know, if I have a chance to make movie like, I don't know, like Inception or the Mad Max Fury Road, you know, maybe I feel like, you know, okay, I'm ready to retire, because that's like, okay, I mean, perfect, almost perfect.
Yeah.
So it's never enough. That's why, you know, that gives me the passion to do again, because I know that, you know, next time I can do better than, you know. But when you're in the middle of this chaos, you know, it's every single day, it's just like, it's either I'm going to kill this, you know, this asshole, or I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to go insane. And I always feel like, no. I mean, I have to do it, because this is the only thing I want to do, and this is the only thing that I'm probably, you know, good at. So it's not really the confidence. It's just, you know, I just lived my life for 50 years that I don't give easy way out to myself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's not really, you know, you can't really recommend this job. It's hard. But again, you know, when you, there's always a moment that, you know, you just in sync with perfect with your crew and the cast and, you know, this amazing shot you get. And when you edit and when you put the music and sound effects, and, you know, my favorite moment is like when I'm doing the final mix of the movie, because that's when everything starts to come together. Right? And normally when you do the final mix, you know, you can just turn up the volume, you know, you can't really do that in the movie theater, right? There's a limit, but
right,
final mixing studio, I'm the king. So I was like, just pump it up. And, you know, and that satisfaction is the best, you know. That's why I can't really get out of this, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of pumping up the volume, music is very meaningful to you. You're a big music fan, but you also have a very interesting way of editing your films to music. Music plays a huge part in the films, in your films. Could you talk about how music influences your editing process?
Thank you for noticing that. You know, not many people notice that, and especially not many Hollywood producers care about that. That's always, I was surprised that, you know, before I moved to Hollywood, I never thought that, you know, that's going to be like, you know, big issue to fight with the producer sometimes, you know, because most of the time they just want this, you know, very typical orchestra, over dramatic music. And, you know, when I tell, you know, my composer, my, you know, mixer that, you know, I don't need music here, everybody starts to feel nervous, like, come on, it's all about this, you know, silence, then this, you know, the music. And everything is, it's not just the background music. It's you know, almost the equal part of the filmmaking, I believe. And I don't know, music was really important because I was a huge fan of this prog rock band called Emerson, Lake and Palmer from UK back, you know, there's a 70s band. And first, my new big music influence was their album called Pictures at an Exhibition, which is an orchestra piece. So, you know, my friend, you know, I went to her room and she played, you know, when I was, I don't know, 13 or 14, I was blowing me away. She played the record of Pictures at an Exhibition. That's an orchestra thing. Then it wasn't. It was like rock, super complicated and cool rock. Oh, like, I was like, you know, wow, man. So I went deep into this, you know, prog rock thing. You know, then I started listening to all kind of rock music. Then, of course, the orchestra and the folk music, and I listened to everything, you know. So the music was always the big part for me. And especially, you know, when you're making the movie, I think it's very, you know, I take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. I don't let my composer just do whatever you're doing good at and, you know, put it on. No, it's, you know, I have a very deep conversation with the composer, and I'm not a composer, so I can't really sing or play, but I know exactly what I want to hear when this, in this particular scene or the particular shot. And so I spend a lot of time and talk with my composers, you know, spend my time, and I just throw them everything, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer to U2 to the Police, or the soundtrack from, you know, Italian horror movie. You know, I just throw everything at them, and I don't want you to copy any of these, but I want you to just mix it up and come up with something that I haven't heard before.
Yeah.
So it's not only about the music, you know, it's the same with the crew and the cast, but I always like to challenge myself mostly, but to my crew that, you know, I don't want you to do something you've done before. And a lot of people, I realize that a lot of people, you know, try to go to that easy road because it's easy. Because if you've done it before, you know how to do it. And that's what I don't really like. So I think that, you know, picking the right person is the most important part of the, you know, filmmaking. Mm-hmm. From the cast to the crew, everybody, you know, because you have to have somebody who I really, really want somebody comes in with 100%, you know, passion, not doing this job for the paycheck. That right. kind of attitude, I don't need it. You know, I understand, I respect, but I don't need it.
Right.
You know? I really need somebody to try to do something very special, you know, and I'm very good at picking the right person, I believe. So that's why I'm always lucky and surrounded by a super talented and passionate crew. So the music is, you know, always a bigger part. And, you know, that's when my childhood memory influence comes back.
Hmm.
Like this, you know, the movie I mentioned called The Breaking Away.
Yeah.
It's a bicycle race, right? It's in the middle of the movie, you know, this kid, Dennis Christopher, you know, he loves everything Italian because Italia is big for the bicycle. So he has an Italian bike, and he tried to speak Italian, and he listened to the Italian music, and he's a crazy kid. And he rides the motorcycle, and there in the middle of the movie, this scene that, you know, he finds out that the Italian team is coming to race in his hometown. So he got super excited. And, you know, so he shouted at his mom, and, hey, Italian, you know, Jim Cinzano is coming. That's when this Italian, you know, this music comes in. Then he gets on the bike, you know, he goes to the highway, and he starts racing, you know, chasing this, you know, truck, Cinzano truck, Italian truck, right? And it's a legendary, just one of the most beautiful scene ever. But, you know, when I was watching the movie, when I was 11, you know, I didn't realize, but the, now I realize that's a huge influence, because the climax of this scene is this Italian music goes up, 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 and this guy keep on speeding up, and in the end, you know, a truck driver looking at his speed meter, and he's going like 70 miles an hour. So, like, this kid is amazing, right? Then, you know, the music goes up, speed goes up. Then this cut to the shot that, you know, Dennis Christopher on a bike, smiling, and he's just riding this motorcycle, the bicycle. And I didn't realize until like years later, but then I realized I'm watching like every 3 months. I realized that, you know, why this shot is so beautiful was in that particular shot at the end of that scene, you know, when he chased the truck, the director only keeps the music, and he just mute every like surrounding sound, you know, and that gives this, you know, moment, I don't know, kind of like spiritual feeling, this yeah. like going higher, higher and higher feeling. And it's just a filmmaking technique, right? But I didn't know when I was a kid, but it surely grabbed me that moment. I was like, that's the filmmaking technique, and that's what you have to do. You know? So I didn't realize until I became the film director and started doing that thing, but the all those movies that I've been watching, you know, ever since I was a kid, and just it's in my, you know, by my blood, my DNA, you know. So I always like try to create this, you know, this moment, you know, silence, then the music comes in and everything just, you know, into one. Because again, that's the director's job, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes, composer, they're professional. You know, they can compose any kind of music, and the DP and the actor, they're all the professional, but you know, somehow I have to put my stamp. I have to make it all into one, unite into one, and create my world. So, music is very, very important, and I've been very lucky because I'm very picky about composing. You know, of choosing my composer, and I'm very lucky to find. And I always try to, you know, do something different. So, my four movies, it's very rare for me, but the past four movies, I've been working with this guy called Aldo Chirac. You know, first movie I did was my Asian movie called Lupin the Third. Mm-hmm. And that movie, I asked him to do something in the zone of like Ocean's 11, kind of jazzy,
yeah.
you know, style, because that fits the movie. Then we did the movie called The Downrange. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment, you know, gives me energy, makes me smile, is that, you know, way before we even wrote the script, way before I started making the movie, you know, Downrange, I just came up with this concept with my my creative partner, Joey O'Brien. He came up with this concept, you know, what if this, you know, there's a sniper in the woods, shot at a tire, you think it's a flat tire, it's not, the tire has been shot out.
Yeah.
And you can't, you don't see where he is. And first he's wearing, you know, he's putting the silencer, so you don't even hear. Only place you can hide is behind the van. And when he told me that idea, I was like, Joey, that's the movie we're going to make. But again, you know, making movies is not easy. So we finally made that movie like after 5 years from the day we came up with the idea. Yeah, because I was doing other things, and, you know, and it's not that easy. But I was so excited about that idea. So, you know, days later, I was having just lunch with Aldo, my composer. So I told Aldo that, you know, hey, you know, listen to this idea, you know. And I told him the concept of, you know, this sniper in the woods idea. And this going to be, I don't need a lot of money to do this. This going to be like, I'm going to kind of go back to what I did on Versus,
yep.
Very indie style. I don't need the star. I don't need the big money. I'm just going to do this, you know, guerrilla style.
One location.
So I give you 100% freedom, you know, as long as you give me something cool. And the first thing Aldo said was like, here's what I'm going to do. You know, after you you're done shooting, you give me the rifle. Then I'm going to bring in the drummer. I'm going to let him come in with a stick, and I tell him to hit every single part of the rifle. Then I record all the sound of the bolt and the trigger and then, you know, the gunshot and everything. And I'm just going to compose the music 90% with the gun sound.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow, I love that idea. So the key is to find that kind of, you know, your team. You know, I mean, when he's told me that, I mean, I just knew that. I mean, wow, you're going to compose all the music with the gun sound only.
That's cool.
You know? And that's what he did. You know, he did. And then, you know, another thing he told me and blew me away was, you know, then years later, we actually made the movie. And I told Aldo that, you know, I still love that concept. So you just composed everything. Then he said, okay, I'm going to record the all possible, you know, sound with the rifle. Then I'm going to put crazy effect, expand and everything, you know, and I'm basically going to create. And here's what I'm going to do. Downrange. When you write down downrange, there's a chord. D, A, G, E.
Oh, look at
that's
that.
That's it. I'm going to use that. That's the only chord I'm going to, only key I'm going to
so
use.
So cool.
It doesn't make any sense, but I'm like, I love that. You're only going to stay to the key D-A-G-E. Yes.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. So he started composing. Then he started composing. Then one day he called me up and he said, like, you know, I need you to come into my studio with your cast. So me and my cast went to studio and said, like, what do you want? Well, I need your voice. Oh, okay. So he put me in this recording booth and said, like, say D, D, you know, lower, D, higher, D, do it again, D, 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 D. Then A, and that's the voice he used for the soundtrack.
Wow.
So every time you know, we cut to the shot of the sniper, mm-hmm. That's my voice.
Oh, wow.
The rest of the scene, the rest of the music is actor's voice.
Wow.
It doesn't sound like voice anymore, you know, because he do all kinds of his magic. But that was very inspiring, you know.
Yeah, because it's such a unique twist to put on a score. And like you said, it's about finding people who will bring unique things to your movies and do things that just haven't been done before.
Mm-hmm. So I really always have this huge respect and appreciation to this, you know, crew. Producer or writer or actor who's willing to, you know, just a little bit, not a huge challenge. It's just a little bit to push mm-hmm. to the limit and, you know, do something interesting, you know, because it's very hard to become film director or the producer or the writer or the crew or the cast, you know, no matter what, you know, it's very hard to get in. Once you get in and once it becomes a job, you know, people starts to, you know, lose the passion, you know, which they had 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right? Because once it becomes your job, it's a paycheck, right?
Right.
But again, you know, to me, it's not really the paycheck. It is very important, but it's not really the paycheck. It's really my life, myself. So, you know, so I've seen a lot of crew cast are like that. They just come in for the paycheck and they do this in a job, you know, 10 hours, then they don't care. And I'm not really want to do something with that kind of people.
Is there a way you can tell when you're casting or when you're selecting crew members if they're in it to win it, if they're really in it for the passion or in it for a paycheck?
I'm not psychic, so I can't be 100%, you know, precise. But so far, yes, sometimes you find out after you start shooting, like, oh my God, I made a mistake. So again,
and I'm sure you develop a sensibility of people when you're talking to them, if they're in it for passion or if they're just looking to get paid.
I'm not perfect, so I make mistake, but and if it's like, you know, crew, yeah, sometimes you can replace, but right. If it's a cast, it's a big deal.
Yeah, you're kind of screwed.
You can't really change the cast, you know, after you know, even one day, you can't throw that out.
Right,
very important. So but so far, you know, even after I came to Hollywood, I've been very lucky, you know. I mean, I had so much fun with Bradley Cooper, and he was, you know.
That's right.
He wasn't Bradley Cooper yet.
When Midnight Meat Train was what, 2009?
We shot that movie 2007.
Oh, 2007, okay.
Yeah, so of course Bradley Cooper wasn't really Bradley Cooper, but it's no surprise, you know. I mean, he was amazing. I basically fell in love with him. You know, I was fixing the script at the office. Then he just walked by, and I was like, "Who's that guy? I want to meet that guy." Right. So I brought Bradley into my office, and we started talking about, you know, because I was still working on the script, so the script wasn't locked.
Okay.
But so we were just talking about, you know, something else. You know, who are you? What do you do? What do you love? And you know, we were talking about ourself and my life, and after 30 minutes I just knew that this was the guy.
Here's your guy.
Yeah. And of course Bradley Cooper, he was amazing all the way, you know. Then No One Lives, Luke Evans, you know, and I was in Japan, he was in Canada or somewhere, so we talked on Skype, and again, you know, we didn't really talk about the script, and we talked about a lot of different things, and I just knew it. And Luke Evans was amazing. And same thing I did was the Ruby Rose on my new movie. You know, exactly like a year ago, I met her in a cafe, and you know, I loved her. You know, already when she walked in, because I'm a Japanese. You know, mm-hmm. I'm very precise. You know, like today, right? I was ready like 3 minutes before our time.
Oh, you were ready to go, yeah.
But come on, you are in New York, it's better, but come on, in LA?
Nobody's on time.
Especially the Hollywood people.
Never.
Never on time. Never on time.
15 minutes late minimum. Later,
yeah, 30 minutes late, you know, they don't even apologize. And I'm getting used to it because I've been living here for 13 years now. But I mean, I was like, really? I mean, that's but you know, it won't change me, so you know. If the meeting is, you know, at 11 a.m., I'll try to be there, especially, you know, if I am about to meet possible my star for my next movie. You know, I was there like 10:30. I was ready, right? Mm-hmm. I was picking the right seat, and, you know, I was ready. Then Ruby Rose came, you know, like 10:45. That's like, whoa, you're a Hollywood star, and you're like 15 minutes early. I mean, that's amazing.
I bet you wanted to cast her just based on that.
Yes. Yeah.
So these little things tell you a lot about actors and crew members, being on time, you know, being respectful and things like that.
It's very hard to find that kind of people, especially when you are a rising star, when you're a star, it's very hard sometimes, right?
Right.
But the Ruby was like that, and you know. So I said, and then, hey, we said, hey, nice to meet you. And, you know, so she asked me, you know, hey, and so you busy these days? So I said, no, not really. You know, I mean, I was watching your movie. Then she said, like, I was doing it because I know that, you know, I was meeting you today. So I was doing the homework.
Yeah.
That's, again, very, I mean, I thought, you know, that's, I felt very passionate from her, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of actors, stars, you know, even though we had a meeting, you know, they don't even know me. Right. So like, mm-hmm. I can't work with someone like that.
Somebody doesn't do that. Yeah. Yeah.
So if I meet my possible star or my crew, I watch everything.
Of course.
I watch everything. Not only one movie. I watch everything, you know.
Do your homework.
Because it's a part of my life. And then I have to spend my, you know, 3 months every day with this person. And, you know, 3 months is only the shooting time. But with this, whatever the end product, I have to live with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, so Ruby Rose was amazing. So after 1 hour, you know, we just felt good. And so, again, let's do this together. And, you know, a couple months later, we were in Romania shooting the movie. So, you know, I've been very lucky, and I've been very, you know, serious about it, you know, because if that connection doesn't work, it's not going to work.
Yeah. You know? Well, speaking of big connections, I heard that when Clive Barker saw the first cut of Midnight Meat Train, it moved him to tears.
Yes, that was very one of the most honored moment in my life.
That's amazing. So, what was your process like in adapting that short story? I've read the Books of Blood, love that short story, and the movie definitely takes some liberties, but it's very much in the soul of the original story, and not every Clive Barker adaptation is like that. But what was it? What was the process like in adapting that, and why do you think Clive Barker responded to it so favorably?
Because, you know, even before Midnight Meat Train, I did this, movie when I was in Japan, movie based on the comic, like Alive, Sky High, Azumi, or even Godzilla. You know, it's, and to be very honest, you know, it's, I don't really want to do that. You know, it's much easier because I can write my own script. You mm-hmm. know, it's much easier, you know, because I don't really want to adopt somebody's baby, you know. And especially when it's like super talented, you know, baby, I don't
intimidating.
Really want, you know, take care of that, right? So, but I always, you know, since I did this movie called Alive, which was my first professional movie, Versus was an independent movie, and Alive was my first professional movie, and I fell in love with the manga. So, you know, this author, Tsutomu Takahashi, he's like my brother now, you know. We did like 3 movies together, and we will do something else, you know, in the future. So he's like my brother. So I really have to take care of his child. So I'm even more serious than doing my original, you know, because I have a responsibility to adapt and take care of somebody's baby, right? Mm-hmm. So Midnight Meat Train, and it was like almost like I felt like almost fake, because it was back in 1987. I quit high school and I went to Sydney. Then my movie friend wrote me email and said like, "Hey, do you hate this movie called this new book from UK called Midnight Meat Train? And Stephen King says it's the future of the horror." I was like, "What? What is that? What is that?" So I asked my girlfriend, "Can you just buy it on the day it comes out and just send it to me?" You know. So she did that, and I still have this first edition of the Midnight Meat Train Japanese edition.
Wow.
So I read it, and of course, Midnight Meat Train was the first of the Book of the Blood, right? Mm-hmm. So I read it, and I was blown away. So I still have that, you know. So of course, then I loved it. I'm a huge fan of the Hellraiser, and I read his old book and an old movie. You know, most of his adaptation movie is too bad, but it's bad, right? But the Hellraiser, Candyman, I loved it. You know? So I was a huge fan. So it was funny that, you know, I was just went into Lakeshore Entertainment for just a regular meeting, and I met the producer Gary Lucchese, and we were talking about like this. We were talking about lots of different things, and he was like, "And I really like you. You know, we should do something together. And I think this is perfect for you." And he gave me the script, you know, and I read the title, and I was like, I just gave him back. No. Like, why? You're talking about the Clive Barker Midnight Meat Train, right? The Clive Barker, right? No. You stupid Hollywood, stop doing this remake or adaptation and make stupid movies. Don't do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want you to do it. And that's what I said to Gary Lucchese, and he laughed and said, "You know, we developed this, you know, very closely with Cribes people. So just take a look. You know, if you don't like it, we'll find something else. But just come on, just take it back." So I took it to my hotel and I read it, and you know, it had a huge potential. So I went in, you know, day after, and they said, "Well, this script still, I think, still needs some work. But, you know, I really think this has a huge potential. So I want to do it." And within like 3 days, you know, they hired me, which was amazing.
Wow.
So we started working in the script. And, of course, it's even harder. I mean, it is hard when you have to work, start from this, you know, long book like Stephen King's novel. Mm-hmm. Like if you have like volume 1, 2, 3, how are you going to make it into 2-hour movie? Which
is,
you know. But also it's hard. If it's like, you know, 20 minutes story, you turn into movie, that's very hard. You know, so a lot of things. And I don't quite remember in detail from the original script, but everything was there. Jeff Buller did an amazing job, so everything was there. But what I wanted to do was, you know, just bring in my just pure love and respect to the world of the Clive Barker. And, even Bernard Rose, the director of Candyman, he wanted to do the Midnight Meat Train as Candyman 2, right?
He wanted to do it instead of Candyman 2?
No, he wanted to do that as Candyman 2.
Oh, so Candyman was going to be like a crossover movie?
I don't know what he was thinking, but...
there was going to be like a Clive Barker universe.
Yes. No, but there must be some, he changed something from the Midnight Meat Train so that it turns into the Candyman 2.
Whoa.
So, but I understand, why 20 whatever years ago he thought about that. This kind of similarity, even though it's a total different story, mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like, the secret world, one is in this, urban legend mm-hmm. thing. Midnight Meat Train is not really about urban legend, but, it has this, the world is not exactly as you see it, right? So that's why that kind of element I wanted to, discuss with the writer and the producer and even the Clive, and I wanted to put in that kind of conspiracy thing. Oh, the cop is part of the team, and then not only the the train driver, it's a cop and everything. So we spent a lot of time, working with the writer, producer, and I went to Clive's house, many times, and I don't even remember why, but the one time, Clive was so angry because he didn't like the changes we made. Because again, that happens all the time. But I was working on something. I don't even remember. I was working on some idea, but it wasn't there yet. So I told the producer not to give this to Clive yet. But of course, they did.
Oh.
So Clive read it, and he was scary.
What was Clive Barker's house like?
Clive's house is like a dream. It's a Disneyland for me. He will have this, I don't know. It's kind of like a doorbell. It's a pinhead.
Oh, no way.
Metal team pinhead.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, so I went to his house. I was like, oh, man, is there any way to detach this? And I want to steal this. He has this cool metal pinhead on his door. His artwork. I mean, amazing. So Clive's house is like a dreamland for
That's
me.
That's so cool.
By the one particular day, it was only one day. He was very angry with the changes. So I had to explain to Clive, this wasn't supposed to get to you yet because I have some idea. Here's what I'm going to do later, this and this and this. And then in the end, of course, he understood it, So it wasn't easy, but, nothing is not – I can't even recall easy filmmaking experience. Every filmmaking experience is like challenging, but Midnight Meat Train was, think about, now looking back now, it went very smooth, but still, I still remember that the big fight was in that. That's one of my few regrets, but in the original script and the original plan, in the end, when the train stops at the Cape and then you see this creature, Fathers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we had the plan to do much bigger. I mean, seriously, much bigger. The entire cave is the creature.
Right.
Shows up.
Wow.
And grab that Leon's girlfriend, Maya.
Yeah.
By Leslie Bibb, and just tear her apart.
Oh my God.
So Bradley Cooper's character, and. Blood, the rain of blood pours on Bradley Cooper. And that's how he had to accept his fate.
Wow.
That was the original. I've never spoken about this, I think, but that was the original idea. And we did the, VFX. I had this genius designer, design this. Basically, what I wanted to do was, creature version of Transformer.
Okay.
Cave starts to move around, then this giant Bradley is like this big, mm-hmm. and this one shows up.
Oh my God.
And all this father hail to this king and grab this girlfriend and tear her apart, and the blood ring, and of course, Leon, Bradley Cooper, he has to accept his fate.
Wow. That was awesome. That would have been amazing.
It would have been amazing, but, you know, one day this, you know, big boss producer came to the set, and that was very unfortunate. You know, he loved what I was doing so far. And, you know, so he started to, you know, because we were shooting in Burbank, in L.A., you know, it was close to Hollywood. So that time, you know, he was producing this big $50 million Diane Lane movie in Louisiana or somewhere. Mm-hmm. But instead of going there, he was, you know, he came to see me,
yeah.
Which was, you know, I was honored to do that. You know, this big producer, Oscar-winning producer, came to see me on the set every day. And he was talking about, you know, what are we going to do next? You know, that was a very happy time. But the one day he came to the set and he went to the restroom and he looked sideways. It's one of the creatures was peeing next to him. And the creature was designed and done by Marshall Mungo, Oscar-winning, you know, the special makeup artist, right? Legendary guy, but doesn't look good when you look him being
in light, in bathroom lights,
not on the set, not under the light, right? So he hated it.
Oh God!
So he came to me and said, "You know, dude, what is that? What is that? That looks like the creature from Black Lagoon back in 1950. What is that?"
Oh, no.
Come on. Give me a break. I've been doing this show and tell every Friday, and I show you all the concept arts, and you approved all the design, and this is done by Marshall Mungo. It doesn't look good when you meet him in the toilet, but it's going to look fine. Aren't you loving what I've been doing so far? I mean, come on. Give me a break. But once he hated, he hated.
Oh, God.
Because I'm a big Hollywood producer, right? So from that day, you know, he just, you know, lots of producers, they were like, I don't know, like 15 producers on the set. And this producer number 10, producer number 9, producer number 8. Everybody called. You know, he's not happy. Boss is not happy about the creature. So we he has a concern about this, you know, the ending. So we have to shoot the plan B. What is the plan B? So you shoot the scene with the creature, then you should shoot the scene with no creature. Well, that's gonna double time everything. I mean, we need more time. I mean, you want me to repeat every single shot? I mean, you can't. I mean, that's not even plan B. What is the plan? You know, that's not fair. You know, everybody approved the concept and the script and, you know, storyboard and design, and you can't. You can't do that to me. If you say plan B, give me plan B. What is the plan B? And nobody answered the question. So I was like under like extreme pressure. It was crazy final. And that was like every like final week was like that, right? Mm-hmm. So of course all the producer started to freaking out that because this director is not listening to the boss. I mean, it's just not fair. Give me the plan B if you say plan B.
Tell me what to do, at least.
And again, you know, like I said, I know I lived as a fighter all the way, so I don't really give a shit.
Right, always
fight. Fire me. Okay, that's fine. You know what? Because it's just unfair. So I wasn't really listening, so everybody went into this panic mode. And, you know, in the end, and like I said, you have to have this one-on-one meeting with the big boss. I mean, that's fine. But it's not going to go, you know, he doesn't like the creature. Because without the creature, this movie will collapse. Mm-hmm. So what is this? Suddenly this Vinnie Jones is, why he's doing this? What is this? It's a different movie. Then we have to shut down and then we have to go back to the script and figure this out.
Oh, God.
It's not the Midnight Meat Train. What are you talking about? No creature. This is not the movie. So I don't mind, you know, meeting big boss, but unless we have the, you know, the new idea, you know, it's not going anywhere. I don't want to end up fighting him. What is this? You know. So I was like, and I had to deal with that while I was already struggling with the schedule and the complicated shoot, you know. But that particular morning, I was so depressed, and you know, and because that this day. When we have to shoot this cave scene ending is like in 2 days.
Wow.
So like, oh my God. So what are we going to do? So I was thinking in the shower and the lightning hit me and basically basically from the moment that the train stops till the epilogue, that was kind of like improvised by me. It was, it wasn't like that in the script. Yeah. So I came up with the idea. So I went to the set and I told the producer and said, like, you know, can you call the big boss? And then I need to talk to him in the lunchtime. So at the lunchtime, you know, it was just me and big boss, you know, and Tom. And I said, Tom, I mean, I know you don't like the creature, but it's really unfair, you know, because you approved everything. And just because you met in the toilet and you don't like it, you can't really tell me to get rid of the monster, because this is the monster movie. And what are we going to do, you know, if you don't like the monster? Yeah. So, you know, but I understand you don't like it, you know, so you really want to minimize, you know, and you don't like the big creature at the end. I understand, you know, but I also understand, you know, we have to have the creature. Mm-hmm. So you don't like plan A, I don't like plan B, because there's no plan B. So only way to solve this is to come up with a plan C, which makes you happy enough and makes me happy enough. So here's what I'm going to do. And I stood up and I basically act all the last scene. And he was finally like, holy shit. All right, you go do that. So he approved that. So I came up with that idea, you know, that, you know, open up the Maya and give the heart and everything, all that, you know.
Yeah. That was a great moment.
It was, but then I really wanted to do that, you know, the big creature. So I even tried. I didn't give up. And I tried, you know, to do the CG mock-up.
Oh, how okay. The
you know, and I show it to him, you know, and he still didn't like it. The VFX guy was this guy, James McQuade. He was an amazing guy, and he did all those, you know, Underworld and the great movies.
Right.
So, yeah, he and I, you know, we still tried to convince. So, you know, we did this mock-up of this big CG and everything, but, you know, he still didn't. So that's what I thought. I mean, like,
Oh, man. Well, a common thread in a lot of your stories is the fact that you don't give up. And I've heard you mention on Mix Podcast that you said that you had like a samurai spirit. Is that something that you come back to as a philosophy?
It is. So, you know, so probably my close friends or my family members, or, you know, everybody think that I'm a bit too hardcore, because to me, you know, I have my own code of samurai, code of honor. And if somebody steps into that zone, I don't really care what kind of damage I get in the end. I get into fight. I'm not talking about the violent fight, because it's just against my philosophy. You know, I can't really. And this, especially in this entertainment industry, there's so many liars and, you know, parasite and sharks and,
yeah.
And it's, you know, and I know, you know, I mean, it's never a perfect world. So yes, you have to have, you know, you have to give this up to gain something. And, you know, I'm doing that, but I know sometimes, you know, they just push me too far. You know, mm-hmm. I call it, you know, samurai spirit, but, maybe the other way to say this is the exterminator spirit.
Exterminator.
I love the movie. You know, if you push somebody too far, yes, he's going to fire. Exterminator is another very important, you know, movie created me. I love that every single moment of that movie. And that was, you know, again, a small indie movie, right?
Right.
And after 35 years, you know, 40 years, still, everybody loves that movie, and I love that movie, you know. And I love that, you know, the movie that when he kidnaps this, you know, the mafia boss, mm-hmm. and asks where's the safe combination, nothing else. If you lie, I'll be back.
Lie, and that's you.
The Doberman dog, right? So he comes back, and he just throw him into this meat grinder. I was like, I watched the movie when I was like 10. I'm like, this is how I live.
Nice. So that's where you got the idea for the meat grinder in No One Lives.
No, that was in the script.
Okay. What was it like working with Daniel Pearl, by the way?
That was like pure fun.
Yeah.
No One Lives was, again, also like, especially as the, I mean, Midnight Meat Train, everything was pretty smooth until this last fight with my big boss.
Right.
You know, because it was a Lecture movie, it was a Lionsgate movie. You know, we had a decent budget, right? No One Lives was in much smaller budget, and you know, we had to shoot it. And of course, why I don't know, but you know, 90% of the movie is nighttime, and you know, of course, we had to shoot that in the summertime. So like, why? Why are we shooting this in summer? So it was tough, but it was chaotic shooting. I mean, it's just like I can write a book about it, how chaotic
really
it was. But and again, I don't want to say bad thing about anybody, but you know, I can say that, you know, only thing kept me, you know, happy and going was working with like this two genius, Daniel Pearl and Luke Evans.
Right. And did you pick Daniel Pearl because of his work on Texas Chainsaw Massacre and you wanted that Southern fried feel?
Of course. And, you know, I didn't pick. I mean, I was surprised that Daniel agreed to, you know, do the movie because he's like, you know, so I met Daniel and I said, like, you know, you're basically my teacher. I didn't learn that much from film school, but I learned everything from your movie, your music video.
I mean, music video.
He shot everything. Michael Jackson, Police, U2, Bruce Springsteen, everything. It's done. So like, you know, I learned everything from your music video. So, you know, so we were instantly connected and it was pure joy.
That's great.
And and the first thing we decided was because we had limited budget and we had, and I didn't want to copy myself. I want to go completely different from what I did on Midnight Meat Train, which was, you know, I did great with this amazing, another genius, Jonathan Seller.
Mm-hmm.
He's now shooting, you know, Transformer, Deadpool, John Wick, everything, you know. So Jonathan Seller was only like 28 or something that time. But, you know, Jonathan and I did, you know, we had so much fun doing Midnight Meat Train. Yeah.
Cool.
So I didn't want to do, of course, it's a legendary Daniel Pearl. You know, I don't want him to do something that I did with Jonathan Seller. So we wanted to do something different. Then we came up with the idea, why don't we shoot this Super 16? You know, we shot that movie 2011, so nobody was shooting film anymore. So I said, like, you know, Super 16, but I still want to do this, you know, anamorphic lens. How do you put that anamorphic onto Super 16? And the only other movie we knew did that was Black Swan.
Okay.
Right. So I think Daniel called the DP of Black Swan, asking him, and he didn't tell.
Of course not. Why would you share your secrets?
He won't tell because you are Daniel Paul, Daniel's son. So you're going to figure out, and he did figure it out. So that was fun, you know, doing this Super 16 animal. And what I found out when I was shooting that chaotic shoot of No One Lives was that, you know, we used to shoot a movie like that, right?
Yeah.
And when you shoot Super 16, the monitor is like this big and it looks like VHS, right? So you don't really care. So after a while, I just started like, you know, I'm going to watch the monitor. I'm going to watch the actor. So Daniel, you're going to take care of the picture. I'm going to focus on the acting. So this is how we make movies.
Yeah, it's what Quentin Tarantino does. He never looks at a monitor when he's directing actors.
These days, you know, it's a hard drive and, you know, this plasma display. And, you know, then what happens is, you know, of course, every actor wants to see that. Can I see the playback?
Oh, yeah. You'll never get the film made that way.
Slow us down. So that was one thing that, you know, we were very, you know, happy. But working with Daniel was again dreams come true moment.
Oh wow, that's great.
And I just recently I had sushi with him and
oh cool,
we will do something again
together. That's great.
But
oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so I've been very lucky with, you know, yes, every crew and cast is very important, but especially DP is very important.
Yeah.
Their job is much harder than the director, you know, because they have to realize and materialize and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're more practical job, and you know, then they have to somehow find a practical way to, you know, realize my crazy vision. So I have huge respect to my my DPs, but I've been very lucky. Like this guy, you know, I had in Japan called Takumi.
Mm-hmm.
Then my first guy in Hollywood is this Jonathan Sella, the genius guy, and then the Daniel Paul. Then I've been working with this three movies with this guy, Matthias Schubert, and he got on board in the middle of this downrange. You know, downrange was another chaotic situation, so we had to shut down. Then, you know, I had to replace the DP, and, you know, he just showed up, and we spoke 30 minutes, and I just knew that Matthias is the guy. And he did an amazing job, so we did this Nightmare Cinema together, we did The Doorman together, and we will, you know, do something together. So I'm always, you know, and Matthias is the guy that, you know, again, like the others, you know, he doesn't care about the paycheck or the, you know, the time card or whatever. He just have this pure love and passion.
Yeah, and that's what you want.
Something very special. So I've been very lucky. My DP, my writer, my composer, my lead actor. I've been very lucky.
That's great.
Sometimes I'm very unlucky with the other
things, but well, as long as you get most of it right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Ryu, hey, I can't thank you enough. This is a real pleasure.
Thank you.
So what is next for you?
I don't know. I mean, I have tons of projects going on. So some of them are horror, but not like what I've done before. And because I'm yes, I love horror movies and making horror movies, but I still think that my very strong thing is action.
Yeah.
And I haven't had a chance to do that, you know, much in Hollywood yet.
Well, I like so, when you combine horror and action.
Yes, that's what I did on Midnight Mitre and No One Lives, right? Yeah. So. And again, Midnight Mitre, my stunt coordinator was David Leitch. He's now a huge director.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so no, he was amazing. So so even though we were making horror movies, you know, when it comes to the final fight between Beanie Jones and Bradley Cooper, you know, we were basically making the action movie.
Yeah.
So, yes, but I really looking to you know, project to showcase my action ability, so which I'm working on right now. So, yeah.
Great.
And after living, you know, 13 years in LA, I'm so far I'm happy here. You know, I have, Hollywood is much slower than, you know, movie making in Japan. In Japan, you know, once you agree, you don't spend time on, you know, months on the contract or anything. You just get into pre-production, and 2 months later, you're on the set. That's the
speed. Wow, that's great.
That is the only frustration I have, you know. Before I came to Hollywood, you know, when I was in Japan, I made like, I don't know, 9 movies in 3 years.
Oh, my God. Because you were filming in Japan.
Yeah.
So is that because just the culture of filmmaking in Japan? Is people just want to go, 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 and they don't fuck around with meetings and development and all that?
No. So, I mean, it's good and bad, you know, because we don't have a union. You know, mm-hmm. So my record, which I'm not planning to break, is 46 hours nonstop. Whoa. Shooting. 46 hours. No lunch, Blake. No dinner. Nothing.
Wow. you can only do that in Japan.
I had to do this, you know, one hour, almost a movie, kind of long music video, but the movie, you know, called Longinus. You know, and this rock star friend of mine asked me to do it, and I only had 2 days off in the middle of the pre-production of the Godzilla movie, which was already chaotic. Mm-hmm. So I had to do this 1 hour movie in 2 days. So only way to do that is like we just shoot nonstop. So we were eating rice balls and sandwich while we setting up the, you know, the camera and the lighting.
That is a true filmmaking samurai spirit.
Yeah. So no, it's so. In this town, you know, if you're lucky, you make one movie in 3 years, which is very frustrating. But I'm you know, speeding up now. So once this pandemic is over, you know, I'm going to write into this, you know, hopefully write into pre-production of my next movie. And I also have some project going on in Japan and Asia. So life is too short. I have to keep on, you know, fighting. Right. Until I'm satisfied 100% with my work, then that's when I retire.
Great. Well, I can't wait to see what you put out next. Thank you again. This was a real Thank pleasure. You. Any parting advice for aspiring directors out there?
you just have to keep on shooting, you know. I mean, don't give any reason, you know, why you are not doing it. Yeah, well, you know, 25 years ago, I was living in this, you know, in Japan, you know, this, everything is so small, right? So I was living in this one room apartment in Osaka, one tiny room in Japan. And I always had this high-end video camera, and, you know, I always had, you know, my best friend who ultimately became a composer of verses.
Oh.
Because like I said, and I was like 25, and when you're 25, you know, people get a job, very busy. But this guy, you know, he wasn't really doing anything, and I wasn't really doing anything. So he was always hanging out in my house, my apartment, tiny room. But, you know, so I can't remember, you know, we shot like, I don't know, probably 20, 30 short movies, just him and me.
Hmm.
Just him and sometimes one more guy. That's it. Everything is in this tiny apartment. And, you know, you'd be surprised at how many, if you really focus, you know, how many crazy ideas you can come up with. So, you know, one of my masterpiece, I believe, is that this one called Otaku Hunter, El Paso. Because, you know, we love movies, right? And we love video games. So, of course, your room is like 100% otaku. Right? So one day I talked to my composer, later to be composer friend, say like, let's do this, you know. So you are the otaku, right? You're listening to this pop idol. You're watching, you know, playing this, you know, Japanese poem video, and you're playing the video game. It's 100% otaku. Then something comes out. This Mexican kind of, you know, Mexican costume guy, because I had this, you know, poncho I bought in Las Vegas or something. So, you know, this Mexican looking guy with the back comes out of the TV and beat the shit out of you and throw you into the TV, turn off the remote, and you are trapped inside this, you know, TV. And that's way before Ring came out. And I shot that in like 2 hours.
Oh, that's so cool.
Then the next day I came up with another idea. This scary guy comes out of the toilet or whatever. So every day I was coming up with this crazy idea. And, you know, I was shooting him and then I act and he shoots me. And if there's a two shot, we put the camera somewhere else. And, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, I did, you know, in this tiny, tiny, tiny apartment. So, you know, compared to that time, you know, right now, if you have an iPhone, you can shoot everything.
Everything.
You have the iMovie, you know, you have the GarageBand, and you can do everything, you know. So it's like a dream time for the filmmaker. So, you know, you just have to come up with something and, you know, keep on shooting everything. So that's my only advice, you know.
Wise words. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
This was great. All right, so much to learn from that conversation. And here, as always, are some key takeaways from this conversation with Ryuhei Kitamura. Number one, always blame yourself. At his lowest point, when nothing was working out and Ryuhei could have blamed producers, actors, and the entire Hollywood system, he instead blamed himself. This was actually an act of self-empowerment, which enabled him to pull himself up by his bootstraps and make things happen because he knew nobody was coming to save him. When things go wrong, it's human nature to find things and people to blame it on. But instead, Ryuhei's story is a reminder to take full responsibility of your entire director path. Hollywood is a fickle beast. It's loaded with liars, sharks, and parasites, as Ryuhei said. When the chips are down, take the blows, learn the lessons, get back up, and take ownership of all of it. The system owes you nothing. You have to fight for every single inch that you get. Number two, be willing to throw it all away. Now, this is an extremely hard lesson, but on Versus, after spending tens of thousands of dollars that he raised from friends and family, Ryuhei looked at what he had shot and realized it was not good enough. This led him to scrap 80% of the footage that he spent months on grueling sets filming. This is heartbreaking, but an inevitable part of the journey. Yes, your material will never be perfect, but regardless of how hard you work on something or how much money you spent on it, if the quality isn't there, it's time to scrap it and start over. You'll have to live with each and every frame of your movies for your entire life, so you really can't afford to put out anything that you're not happy with. Number three,
Make outrageous demands, and you'll be surprised how often you get what you want. After talking to enough directors, I realized that movies are made up of a bunch of mini miracles, and you have to believe they're possible in order for them to happen. After shooting Versus on a shoestring budget, Ryuhei boldly approached one of the top editors in Japan and asked him to edit his movie for free. The guy laughed at him at first, but Ryuhei's conviction persuaded him to actually do it, and he edited the movie. This substantially boosted the quality of Versus, and it put Ryuhei on the map, and he was eventually able to pay the guy back. To make a movie is to literally do the impossible with limited time and on a limited budget. Often the only thing that will get your movie made properly is your own boldness and determination to make the impossible possible. This means you have to be bold, and you have to make some preposterously outrageous demands. And when you do, you may be surprised how often people say yes. Despite the fact that Hollywood can be rough, don't forget there are angels as well as demons. You'd be surprised at how often people in the industry want to help filmmakers out because they know how difficult the job is. This is both a matter of getting out of your comfort zone and also believing in the power of possibility. So if you identify an opportunity like this, ask for it. The worst they can do is say no. Anyway, guys, thank you as always for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the world to me if you shared it with your friends and family on social media. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at I'm Nick Taylor. That's I am Nick Taylor. Twitter on the same handle. And if you dug this episode, let me know what you liked the most about it. Thanks a lot, guys.